on, now it's on. Oh, I gotta do a clap. And clap.
Don't forget the clap.
And we are back once again with the beautiful, magnifico ATP podcast Around the Post with your boy Jay here and the magnificent co-host, Mark Figueroa. Oh man, I'm in a good mood today. I'm feeling good. And this is episode 183. And before you say a word, I want you to know I got some content tonight. I got some stuff up my sleeve. Let me straighten my hat for the YouTubers. Like, subscribe, comment. I'm trying to practice being more of a video guy because we talk like it's just audio all the time. How are you feeling today?
Pretty good. Okay. A lot of news. I don't like to talk again. We don't like to talk about on-court stuff because that stuff you guys could look up. I like to talk about the stuff outside.
Yeah.
Which makes it more interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're going to start with Garbiñe Muguruza. Mm-hmm. Obviously, she announced her retirement. Mm-hmm. She hasn't been playing tennis for over a year and a half, maybe even more than that. Mm-hmm. But she finally made it official. They pressured her to say if she wanted to play in the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And she didn't give an answer. And she was just toying back and forth. But finally, she made her retirement.
Okay.
Former world number one. Mm-hmm. WTA finals champ, Wimbledon champ, defeating Venus Williams, and French Open champ beating Serena Williams.
Hmm.
What are your thoughts on the career of Garbiñe Muguruza?
Isn't she pretty young?
Yes.
A little surprised at the retirement, and I would go as far as having the hot take of maybe this isn't really the end of her career. And maybe we'll see her make an appearance somewhere down the road. I want to say she's early 30s, 30.
Yes.
You know, yes, something around like that. She's pretty young, but accomplished a lot. I'm going to do some research on her as we continue this podcast. But obviously the real question for me is this a Hall of Fame athlete?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure. Defeating the Williams sisters to win both their slams.
Hmm.
That's pretty big.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Congratulations to her if she doesn't return to the tour. But I do think the tour is better with her on it, and she's still very young. So I hope to see Muguruza play a little more tennis, you know. But yes. We'll see. You know, it's definitely something. I'm sure she didn't take the decision lightly, and she seems like she had a lot on her mind when she was on the cusp of making it. So
yes.
Yeah, I definitely think there's more in the tank.
Yes, yes, a big power hitter as well. So she had a great career for sure. So I'm going to announce the champions now.
Hmm.
excuse me. We have Sloane Stephens winning Ruhan.
Hmm.
She beat Lynette 6-1, 6-2. Sorry, 6-1, 2-6, 6-2. And she said, clay court season, I'm here.
Let's go.
She's been kind of, you know, stale a little bit, hasn't been doing a lot of noise, but she got a title. What are your thoughts on her?
I mean, you know my thoughts on Sloane from past episodes, but what I can say is she's a player that's, I mean, if there was ever an era where she could sneak several titles, it's right now. I feel like 250 and 500 events are a great avenue for a Sloane Stephens specifically.
Yes.
Who is a good ball striker, a great athlete, still knows how to win, but just, I'm not sure how many hours these days are spent on the practice court, how serious she is about the bigger events and stuff like that, but the talent is there. The discipline could be there. If she wants to win events, I still think she's more than capable of winning events. So this doesn't surprise me. It just shows me that she's putting in the work and she's here to win.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Moving on to the other champion, I'm going to save her. Obviously, it was Rybakina, but I'm going to save her for a little later.
Okay.
So, as you know from last week's episode, Halep was given the Madrid wild card, but she turned it down and she said she just wasn't ready to play. And she needed more training as far as her physicality. So, they gave the wild card to Raducanu.
Nice.
Who actually had a nice showing in Stuttgart. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a great replacement. Raducanu sells seats. Raducanu plays good tennis. She, like you said, she had a great showing at her previous event. So I'm a big Emma Raducanu fan in general. So I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yes, I agree. And now the big news here is that the the PIF, which is owned by the Saudis, they're putting big money into Madrid. And they're making adjustments to the tournament. As you know, last year there was a cake gate with Alcaraz receiving this massive cake and Sabalenka receiving this little weeny cake. Then there was having women, ball girls in tank tops.
Yeah, smaller, more
crop tops, maybe. Yeah,
smaller clothing, essentially. Yes.
And then Azarenka and Hadid Maia winning the doubles, and then they didn't allow them to speak, and they cut them short. So before I talk about what is going on, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think Madrid can bounce back from that?
I mean, more money means something of significance will be noticeable. So I'm looking forward to seeing where this money gets spent. And I think this is a great tell sign of what we can expect to see in our World Tour Finals.
Yes.
This is going to be the first sign. So hopefully they do great things.
Yeah, so they're adding, so they're doing a platform to allow tennis fans, new and old, to engage and train with legendary players at the event.
Okay.
So that's pretty good. Is that a good start for what Madrid did last year?
Yeah, and it seems like that in itself is going in style now. This, for $5,000, have a session with Martagalu. For $6,000, go see Alcaraz. Or, you know, there a lot of this is happening now, and it seems like a cool way for the tournament and the players to make a little extra cash. So, you know, I think it's cool.
And then they're doing ground zones to where the youth and certain fans have access to players as well. So the Saudis are putting in big money for that as well. And then they're also trying to expand programs so players around that area could get more access to it. So maybe Madrid will gain a little bit of momentum from what they did last year.
Yeah.
So now we're going to talk about a statement that Iga made. And this is a big one. She said, me, Sabalenka, and Rybakina are the best players on tour, honestly. She forgot to mention Coco Gauff, who is ranked higher than Rybakina.
Did she forget or did she exclude?
She excluded.
Okay.
So what are your thoughts on that statement?
Look, this one's a little tricky. For me, the best way to put this is Coco Gauff is new to the club. She's the freshie. She's the new person. And I think she hasn't earned the respect of Iga in particular because of their head-to-head series numbers. I think that Iga sees Rybakina and Sabalenka, as we may discuss in a moment here, as threats.
Yes.
You know, she considers them people. If they're in her draw, her ears perk up. If Coco Gauff's in her draw, I don't think she's concerned or scared, although that she has that one loss last year. Coco Gauff is the fourth best player on the planet easily, but she's debatably the third best. I'm not sure. Rybakina has had an incredible year. Incredible. Better than Coco Gauff. So I am curious to see how things play out. But what I can say, and to side with Iga a little bit, is what Rybakina has been doing is playing at a top five level for a longer stint of time than Coco Gauff has.
Correct.
So I think it's right to put Rybakina in this conversation. I don't know if it's right to not call it a big four. That's the real question. Because Rybakina is in the big three for sure.
Yes. So this year, Coco Gauff is 19-6, 76% win rate, one title. Rybakina, 26-4, 86.7% win rate, three titles this year.
Came out the gate this year and got a title.
Right.
And it hasn't stopped yet.
Again, the stat from last week, you guys could look it up from last week's episode, but it was 200 winners in a tournament in Miami, Rybakina. So those are big, big numbers. So I just think that Iga fears Rybakina. They can she can hit through her. Obviously, she beat her in Stuttgart.
Yeah.
Sabalenka can hit through her when she has everything going. And as I like to call her, Mommy Iga owns Coco. So I can see why she made that statement. So now mentioning Rybakina winning Stuttgart. Funny story, she doesn't have a license. So when you win the tournament, you drive the Porsche down onto the court. But she doesn't have a license, so she was escorted. She was chauffeured down.
She Ubered down.
She Ubered down. What are your thoughts on that?
It's pretty funny. And it's funny because everyone's talking about her being one step closer to winning that Porsche. And they were talking about that on her way through the draw. And she's probably going, I need to go to the DMV.
Exactly.
So that's pretty funny. But once again, congratulations to Rybakina, who I'm a big fan of for winning Stuttgart.
Yes, I am a big fan as well. She's a really solid player. But now let's talk about Coco Gauff. She said she has reached the pinnacle, which was winning the U.S. Open. But now she has another goal. And that is winning the French Open. She said she went to France as a child multiple times to watch Roland Garros. She says that she felt that she was really close winning Roland Garros. And that's her next slam to win. Do you agree? Do you think that Coco Gauff has a chance to win Roland Garros?
Yeah, I think she does have a chance. I think that she's going to have to climb Mount Everest if she's going to run into Iga in the final, you know, but outside of that, I don't really see anyone else on the tour where I don't think she has a chance.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's a great goal for her. That's a great goal for someone who already has a Grand Slam. And I really think it would solidify her in history to have a clay court Grand Slam.
Yes.
You know, because winning the U.S. Open is an amazing feat. That's your hometown slam. That's the one you should do first. And if I had to pick one for her to do next, I think that one would say the most and speak to what she's capable of the most. That's a big confidence builder, winning a French Open. You know, we've seen anyone who's won a French Open in the last 15, 20 years has more than one slam. You know, so it says a lot to have one.
Yes, she actually is a great dirt baller, but Iga is the Mount Everest.
Yeah.
So that's the problem there. If Iga wasn't there, I would feel more confident.
Yeah.
But with Iga there, it's a tall mountain to climb, but it is possible.
Yeah,
you never know. So now talking about Sabalenka, she lost to Vondrousova. And by the way, this is only the first time that she's made a quarterfinal since winning Wimbledon in a tournament, Vondrousova, and then she upset Sabalenka. What are your thoughts there?
Keep an eye on Vondrousova. We've seen these like glimpses of brilliance from a player that can turn into something pretty big. And Sabalenka, to me, is no pushover. I don't think Sabalenka's in a slump. This is something of significance.
Okay, so I apologize. I believe I said quarterfinal. It's semifinal.
Yeah.
So this is the first semifinal that she had reached prior to winning Wimbledon. She hasn't done very well since. But speaking of Sabalenka, she actually has been struggling a little bit. This was her first quarterfinal appearance since winning the Australian Open. So she's kind of on the shaky ground. So what are your thoughts on Sabalenka? She was a three-time finalist in this event, and then she didn't make it.
I'm not too worried. I think that Sabalenka still has great opportunity this year, and her temperament it's moved around a bit throughout a regular season. It's not unusual for her to have an odd stint, but I have confidence that she'll make noise throughout this year.
Okay. For sure. So to conclude the conversation, Sabalenka did beat Coco at Australia. Sabalenka has a slam this year. Rybakina's been winning everything. Iga's there. So is Iga correct? Is Sabalenka, Rybakina, and Iga the best players, excluding Coco Gauff? Is she right?
For sure. Absolutely. They're the big three. Coco Gauff just entered the chat and I think that the rest of this year will tell us if it's a big four or a big three.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay. I like that. That's a very good one. So now, Iga, as you know from last week, this is her 100th week as the world number one.
Hmm.
What are your thoughts there?
I mean, she's earned the right to make wild statements. 100 weeks at number one. I'll let you tell me who the best players on the tour are. I'll let you say that. She's showing a level of consistency, now has rivals to add value to the time she spends at number one. You know, her having Sabalenka and Rybakina on the tour with her while she does this, it creates credibility and it makes what she's doing mean more. So I think that this is a great era for her. I love that she has rivals. I love that she has players who are taking slams and staying consistent with her in the top five. This is all great things.
Yes, and there's only 8 players that have spent more weeks at number one than her. Mm. And it is a who's who.
Mm.
You have Justine Henin with 117 weeks at number one.
Mm-hmm.
You have Ash Barty, 121 weeks at number one. You have Monica Seles, who I believe that if she didn't get stabbed would have had more weeks.
Mm-hmm.
178 weeks at number one. Martina Hingis, who was one of my favorite players.
Mm-hmm.
I love watching her. 209 weeks at number one.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Evert, 260 weeks at number one.
Mm-hmm.
Serena, 319.
Mm-hmm.
Martina Navratilova, 332.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the big one, Steffi at 377. What are your thoughts on that incredible list?
She is in the company of absolute Hall of Fame legends. And if she stopped right now and was at the end of that list, she would not get any less respect from anyone in the world. That is insane. She would just make that list that much better and longer.
Yes, I agree. She's going to surpass Justine Henin very shortly.
Yeah.
So she's climbing up that leaderboard for sure. And I believe that once she gets to about 4 or 5, we can start talking about best ever.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that?
I'm going to need to see a little bit more separation between her and her rivals to call her best ever. And I think that's my real defining factor. The reason Serena, although she doesn't own every single statistic, is often referred to as the GOAT, is how she separated herself from her rivals.
Right.
It's kind of the reason Pete is still in some people's top 5 men ever.
Yes.
And I think that Iga needs to display that a little better. Then, weeks at number one aside, then we'll know.
Yes. So
that's what I need from her. But nonetheless, 100 weeks at number one just speaks to the discipline, the consistency, the hard work. She's doing so much off the court to keep that. So we've seen her have off weeks, off tournaments, and come up with results.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm a huge fan of what Iga's doing, and she deserves all her accolades.
Yes, 100%. Moving on to the men, apparently, according to First Sports, an icon is returning to the game.
Mm.
So, as you know, this person was banned because they missed a doping appointment.
Mm.
And then before the sentence was released, he just said, I'm done. But now he's back.
Mm.
Michael Emer.
Oh, really?
He said retirement was boring. So I'm back.
The drama man.
What are your thoughts on an ATP icon coming back?
I don't ever want to hear you call him an icon again, first and foremost. Secondly, the tour is funner with him on it, okay? This guy brings a little drama. He brings a little controversy. I'm not in love with watching him play, per se, but this is someone I'm not mad to see on the tour. I think that these storylines he can bring to the table make it a little enjoyable.
Yes.
But I don't see it meaning anything to the actual tour itself. The yes. rankings, the success, the tournaments. Yeah.
I just thought it was a funny story. The way the wording of it for sure was hilarious.
Yeah, it's super funny. I totally thought you were going to say like a Brooksby or something. Then you said Emer. I didn't see that coming. You got me by surprise for sure.
There you go. And excuse me, for the first time since 1989, no Spanish player made it to the quarterfinals in Barcelona.
Wow.
As you know, Nadal lost in the second.
Yeah.
And Alcaraz did not play due to injury. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we know the 2010s were owned by Spaniards. Feliciano Lopez, David Ferrer, Rafael Nadal. I mean, and there's the Mark Lopez. There's a bunch of guys, you know, that were just filling up the rankings and owning these clay events, truly. And this is just speaking to the generational change that there are just less Spaniards in the top 50 on the tour, period. Much less in the 2010s. And there's also just the coincidence of the top Spaniards all being inactive right now. They're not playing. So this isn't a crazy statistic. It's just a coincidence.
Okay, that's fair.
But I do think there are less dominant Spaniards on the pro tour right now. That's a fact.
Okay, I can give you that one.
Yeah.
And now congratulating the champions. We had Fuskovic winning a title.
Let's go.
Jean-Lennard Struff.
Like it.
And we'll get into that right now. Mm. As a matter of fact, Jean-Lennard Struff beat defending champion Holger Rune. And in a convincing fashion.
Yeah.
6-2, 6-0.
Jeez.
Now let's talk about Holger a little bit. He's had, we could probably say, embarrassing losses to Morjan and now to Jean-Lennard Struff. And in convincing fashion in less than 55 minutes, both matches. What are your thoughts? Is there a problem with Holger right now?
There's absolutely something mentally going on with Holger. I'm a little confused as to what it is, but he's struggling with something. You know, to see these performance drop-offs from him in events where he works his way to finals, semifinals, he plays high-level tennis, he closes out tough tiebreaks, and then gets bageled by a guy outside the top 20. You know, it just doesn't really make sense to me. And I know that we're seeing a lot of craziness going on with him as far as his team, his circle, things off court. It's been turbulent. I'd like to see more stability with him off the court, and maybe that will feed into what he's doing on the court. But I don't know how.
Yes, I don't know. These struggles are weird to me because he's such a high-ranked player. You'd think that he would find himself to work through them. But the fact that he hasn't is mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
So this is Fuskovic's first title in 6 years, by the way.
But Fuskovic has been, I would call him a high-tier top 80 player.
I could say that, sure.
I just think that he's the guy who you don't want in your first round, but you'll draw him in the first round.
Yes.
He's a very physical specimen. He's very flexible, very strong, very fit. He has a solid overall game, just nothing truly penetrating and piercing that he does. But he covers court well. He can hit fairly large. He's got spin. He's a great athlete. You aren't going to beat him with just physicality. So what I mean by that is if you're just a grinder, he's your worst nightmare.
Right.
You're going to have to beat him with tennis. So I like Fuskovic a lot. I think he's a great test for players, especially the Dominic Thiems, the Stan Wawrinkas, the Andy Murrays, the guys that are kind of on the fence with because we know they have the talent and they've been at the highest level. I think when they beat a Fuskovic, we know that they're coming back to the highest level again.
Okay.
He's a good barometer for me.
Okay, that's fair. And now Jean-Lennard Struff is the oldest player to win his first title since Paolo Lorenzi in 2016.
Wow, okay.
What are your thoughts there?
He's been knocking on that door for some months now. He's had some good runs. He's had some deep runs. And so this kind of feels right. It feels right to me. And he did it in magnificent fashion. He did not sneak in a little 250 in the corner room. He beat a guy who's been ranked as high as number 4 in the world in a final. This is great. So congrats to him.
It's shocking to me because he has such a massive serve. Mm-hmm. And for him to be doing so well on clay.
It's odd.
It's odd and speaks a lot to his prowess for sure. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to talk about the Barcelona champion, who you just mentioned. This is his biggest title in his career. He has about 10 250s. Don't quote me on there. I'm just going over the top of my head. Our boy, Casper Ruud.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Biggest win in his career, defeating Stefanos Tsitsipas. You're talking about Sloane Stephens said, clay court season this year. That's Casper Ruud right now.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on his great victory?
I have a lot to say about this. So I got a little flack on our from our fan base, our listeners.
Yes.
From our listeners for being a Casper Ruud hater. And
which I'm not, by the way.
I want to speak to it a little bit here. We're talking about a guy who's been ranked 5-4 in the world at some point, has been to Grand Slam finals.
Multiple.
And this is over a span of multiple years. Mm-hmm. He just won his first non-250 tournament. It just doesn't really make sense that he's a clay court specialist, top five in history, and
top five in the world.
Has been top five in the world. You know what I mean? And he just transcended the 250 event level. It's a little confusing for me because what's missing? What does it tell us? Does it mean he doesn't do well under pressure? Does it mean there's something in his game missing? Does it mean he found something in his game now? Or does it speak to Tsitsipas giving up a win after they play in their second consecutive final? What does it mean? Or does it mean nothing and he was supposed to have just done this a long time ago? What are your thoughts on Casper Ruud's unusually late breakthrough?
Okay. Well, before going on to answering that, he also was one match away from being the number one player in the world.
He was.
If he would have defeated Alcaraz at the U.S. Open, he would have been the number one player in the world.
Would he have been the worst world number one in history?
I mean, it's hard to answer that question. He did have...
That might be the YouTube title of this snippet.
Yes, because he definitely would have had a Grand Slam.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Marcelo Rios, who was a number one player for a long time, smooth as heck, did not have a Grand Slam. I'm going to double check there, but I am sure that that's what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your question, he definitely was in the right bracket at the French Open when he made it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had the big brother syndrome with Nadal. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, he even thanked him in his speech because he won at Rafael Nadal Stadium and said, I grew up watching him and it's great to win in his stadium.
Mm-hmm.
So he had big brother syndrome there for sure.
Yeah.
And then to answer the question with Alcaraz, it was probably the fact that Alcaraz just had more firepower, and it was kind of bad that Alcaraz had so many great wars, and Ruud was fresher.
Yeah.
So he probably should have won.
Yeah.
So that is a little disappointing there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But, excuse me, he is second on the list with most wins in 2024.
Mm-hmm.
You have Dimitrov has 22 wins in the season.
Mm-hmm.
Ruud has 24.
Mm-hmm.
And Sinner has 25. What are your thoughts on that?
It speaks to the consistency and the volume. We know Casper Ruud is a guy who goes deep in most events he plays in. The question with Casper Ruud is, can he win a big event? That's usually the question. It's not, is he going to show up and perform and beat the people ranked lower than he is? It's, is he going to get to the finish line and beat the people ranked higher than he is? That's the million-dollar question. So,
right.
I just want to know if he's going to... Is he going to grow past being a gatekeeper or not?
I think he will.
Yeah.
Yes. He's getting there. He's starting to make hard court finals as well. He did well in Acapulco.
Mm-hmm.
So he's starting to do well.
Okay.
And yes, Marcelo Rios did not win a Grand Slam. So Casper Ruud would have had one at that point. So I wouldn't say he was the worst.
Okay. Second worst.
Marcelo Rios was a great player. Okay, so now we're going to talk about Nadal. We're going to talk about Nadal at the very end, but this is pretty big news.
Mm-hmm.
He has decided to play Laver Cup. He will be at Laver Cup. And Roger Federer did a tweet saying, let's go, vamos. So there you go. What are your thoughts on Rafa being in Laver Cup?
Look, they're pulling, and I told you this last year, they're going to pull every string possible to make Laver Cup an explosive event this year. And I don't think that's an easy accomplishment. I really don't. But they're finding ways. I think Laver Cup this year has to be very successful and very exciting for it to continue for the next 5 years. So this is huge news. Yes. Even if he just plays a little doubles or he doesn't play heavy, this is great.
Right. Excuse me. So now we're going to talk about more Nadal news since I just brought him up. Mm-hmm. He's playing the American 16-year-old. One of our listeners told me to bring him up again. So I'll say what I've said in recent podcasts. Mm. Darwin Blanche. Mm. He plays out of the Alcaraz. He's Alcaraz's partner. Mm. He's his hitting partner. He's been hitting at the Ferrero, Juan Carlos Ferrero Academy. Mm. And they've been training partners for a while now. Mm. He is a ITF maybe number 10, I believe. So he's on the rise, solid player. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that? On that Darwin Blanche Nadal matchup?
Extremely exciting. I have a hot take that him and Nadal never actually play on that court for that match.
You think he's not? You think Nadal's withdrawing?
I think so. Interesting. I have no reason to believe that. It's just a gut feeling, but we'll find out. And I hope they do play.
Okay.
I'm really looking forward to seeing how that goes and what happens, but I don't know. Nadal seems to be the most protective of his legacy of any of the retiring acts we've seen in years. He is very hesitant to show up and not be the guy we remember him as. And I don't think he wants to go down in history with that tail end of ugliness that a lot of the pros don't know how to say no and let go. He seems very protective of that moment. So we'll see.
Okay. Well, in that case, your theory may be correct because he did say, either yesterday or today, if I arrive in Paris in the way I feel today, I will not play. Mm-hmm. He went on to say, there's more that I want to accomplish in my career. I still have goals, and one of them is the Olympics. Mm-hmm. So pretty much, if he doesn't play at Roland Garros, it's not the end. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on that statement?
Yeah, he's already planting seeds of doubt with whether or not he's going to play at the French Open now. Right. This is terrible. We do not want to hear this. He was just talking about, looks like a good place to die. You know, and now the energy has shifted completely. Now it doesn't have to be there. I don't have to play there. If I don't feel competitive, I won't play. And I'll just wait and wait and wait. And now he's already has commitments to essentially the Olympics and Laver Cup. He almost is committed to a full calendar season.
Right.
He's knocking on the door 1 or 2 months away from a full season. So it's interesting. I really do hope he plays the French. And I really thought he was going to be done at the French.
Right.
You know, so it's interesting to hear him say he's going to attempt the Olympics. Seems a little odd to me, honestly. And then it's interesting to hear that he's going to do Laver Cup. Even as much as I think that's exciting, maybe he's going to emulate the Roger Federer walk away, play a Laver Cup doubles, have all his friends and buddies there. We say farewell there, and then that's the end. I think that'd be fine. And then we just start calling Laver Cup the graveyard. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yes, it is surprising that he keeps saying, well, I'm just not ready physically and I just can't go. A lot of people are saying, why doesn't he just retire? Mm-hmm. But at this point in his career with 22 Grand Slams, he's earned the right to do what he wants. So if he wants to keep entering and then withdrawing, then it is what it is. Mm-hmm. So that's my take there. So moving on to Djokovic, he withdrew from Madrid. Mm-hmm. Pretty big news. Are you shocked by that?
A little bit. But with Djokovic, I think he's at that point in that phase where he does want a light schedule and he's going to make sure he peaks at Roland Garros. And I think his goal is to win the French Open. I think that's all he's concerned with at this point in time. And he knows, let's be real here, our number one player in the world did not win his signature slam. He needs to win this French Open for his ranking, for his points, for his confidence and morale, to prove a point to the rest of the tour that he still has the invincible aura. There's a lot of reasons he needs this French Open. Because if we see Djokovic for the first time in I don't know how long go on a drought like this for the first half of a year, does the rest of the tour start thinking he bleeds and he's human? And what does that mean for him now going through a full-length draw?
Right.
I think that we could see a big trickle effect if he doesn't make major noise at this French Open. If he does anything less than lose in the final, I think the rest of his season sees a different trajectory and a different level of competitiveness and confidence from a Francis Tiafoe, a Felix Auger-Aliassime. You know, they start thinking they have a chance when they walk on the court against a Novak. So, let's see.
Djokovic is the type, as we know now, he wants every record. He says he wants an Olympic gold medal.
Mm-hmm.
He does not have an Olympic gold medal.
Mm-hmm.
So I really think that although the French Open is big, he's mentioned that he really wants that medal. Mm-hmm. And he was even complaining that he's disappointed that they're going to play Wimbledon prior to the mm-hmm. Olympics. Mm-hmm. Do you think that he wants that gold medal more?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think the Olympic gold medal is his number one objective this year, as well as probably protecting his number one ranking, which is making noise at slams to get points. And I think that his initial goal was to win everything the whole year, which clearly isn't happening. But I think his next goal in line is to knock out that Olympic gold medal, because if he doesn't, he's going to be 41 the next time he has a chance to win it.
Right, I agree. So he also won the Lures Sportsman of the Year award.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Federer and Novak have 5, which is shocking to me. Usain mm-hmm. Bolt has 4.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Tiger Woods, Michael Schumacher, Nadal, and Messi with 2.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations to Novak, but to be a little controversial, are you shocked that he won Sportsman of the Year? With the tantrums he throws and all that stuff?
A little bit. Only a little bit. I do think that Novak's sportsmanship towards other competitors and athletes, I respect.
Right.
Novak's attitude towards organizations, fans, staff, and things like that are a little bit less admirable, a little more loose from him and less consistent. But Novak, the sportsman, when competing with other sportsmen, is definitely a man worth awarding. I'll say that. I think even the players he dislikes, you know, I love the way he behaves on the court when it comes to competitiveness and the way he interacts with other athletes. I'm a big fan of it. You know, when he gets hit by a ball, I love the fierceness he contributes. When he loses, I love the speeches and the things he has to say and the insight he provides to his competitor. It's not really excuses. So as far as the sportsmanship thing goes, I like him. I don't know by definition of sportsmanship if the umbrella of interactions with staff in tournaments and stuff like that are included in that. Because if they are, he shouldn't have a single one.
I agree. No,
but,
I agree.
But if it's just interacting with other athletes, then I understand why he has so many.
No, I that makes sense what you just said. He's really respectful to his opponents, even when he felt sick. And I will, unlike people who they always blame him that every time he says something, when he says that he's sick, people don't believe him.
Mm-hmm.
But when Nadal says it, everybody believes him.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that there was something wrong with him at the Australian Open, but he gave full credit to Sinner.
Yeah.
So he's very respectful to the players.
Yeah.
Now the antics he does with the crowd and all that.
Yeah.
That's a little different. And that to me falls under the umbrella of sportsman. And I honestly don't think he should win it.
Yeah. If I don't know the dictionary definition of sportsmanship down to the nitty gritty. So like you're saying, if it involves crowds, referees, things like that, why does he have so many? Like, is it because he's just been on the tour so long?
Right.
And he's had a couple good years. But if it is the culture he builds when it comes to the way he supports other athletes, he supports up-and-coming tennis players, he supports his rivals and his new rivals and his old rivals, the way he treated Medvedev, the way he treats fellow Serbian tennis players.
Right.
We're talking about an incredible human in that regard.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm going to look up that definition in the dictionary after this episode, but I'm sure the people watching will be able to tell us their opinions of Novak Djokovic. He has very dedicated fans, and he also has very dedicated haters as well.
Oh, big time.
And I'm going to look up that definition for my own sanity to make sure I know whether or not he should have this award. Because all the other people you listed, they just seem to deserve it.
Yes.
I don't even doubt it. So
yes,
I'd like to know if Novak should be that way as well.
I agree. So in that speech, in that arena, he said it's actually good to have a full team, a physio. He's into analytics. Mm-hmm. He's into obviously having a coach. Mm-hmm. So he said it is important to have that. It is a winning formula, a successful formula. Mm. But at this point in my career, I can afford not having a coach and seeing what I decide to do. Mm. What are your thoughts on that statement?
It's a little ironic for him to say the exact quote of, I can afford to not blah, 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 because he can literally afford to have it, you know, in the literal sense. But I understand where he's coming from. And I think we spoke to this a bit also when we first got news. And that was that he's been on the tour so long. He's played these players so long. He's seen so many sequences and situations. He can probably coach himself to a slam title. He has had the interactions and he's done the problem solving and the troubleshooting on the court and the adapting. This is a guy who doesn't need a coach. He can bring in a coach because he wants one.
Right.
But he doesn't absolutely need it. He can afford to walk on that court and find success by himself. I truly believe that. And we've seen him make adjustments live on the spot against athletes without talking to a coach. We've seen it happen in Grand Slams. So, yeah, I think he's right.
He said that he is going to make a decision soon. So with that being said, what are your inclination? What is your inclination? Coach or no coach?
Coach.
Okay.
I think he gets a coach.
All right. And again, the leading candidate is Zimonjić, who is Serbian as well. They've played on Davis Cup. Mm-hmm. And he was there in Monte Carlo. So who else do you think would be a good fit?
I can't think of anyone we haven't already kind of guessed or speculated on. But we'll see. Not Federer.
Not Federer, yes.
Not Federer. I don't know why the Tennis Channel even threw that name out there outside of maybe looking for some engagement, but not Federer. Zimonjić, I like, is an option. And what was the other one we listed? Do you remember?
Becker.
Becker. Becker's also an option. And, of course, his original coach that he has this...
Yeah, Miriam Vida.
Yeah, this back-and-forth thing he's got going on with. So those are the only options I think are possible, those three guys. So we'll see.
Okay. And then the last... statements and a topic I have is Sinner and Alcaraz. So Rick Macy, who coached Serena and Venus when they were young, said that Sinner and Alcaraz are separating themselves from the pack. Mm. They're going to win a lot of slams. There is no big three. Mm. There will be contenders fighting with them, but they're going to separate themselves from the pack. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that statement?
I mean, it's happening now, you know, so I don't think it's a hot take. I don't think that that's real speculation involved in that statement. I think that Sinner and Alcaraz, as far as people cutting through and penetrating the tour, there's who else is there? There's no one. Medvedev has made his peace and statement. I think Medvedev is a lead competitor. He's still not really a favorite at any slam he goes to, but he's always in your top four picks. I like that for him. But Sinner and Alcaraz, I would go as far as saying they've separated themselves from him at slams also.
Okay.
So for me, it's Djokovic, then it's Sinner, Alcaraz, then it's Medvedev, then it's everybody else.
Okay. You don't. What about Zverev, Tsitsipas? You don't think they have it?
I think that they're both capable of a slam. I don't think that they have made any statements so loud that we need to put them in that conversation of them being in the same conversation as Medvedev. Okay. The same conversation as Alcaraz and Sinner. They're the tier right below Medvedev. They're the guys that are threats. They're the guys that are talented enough. They're the guys that have gotten to that point and they've made it to Grand Slam finals and lost. And, you know, I think it's going to require them to make a big change within themselves to convert and get to that next level. but something big would have to change for them to surpass the people we listed.
My dark horse pick is going to be Zverev. I don't know if you knew the stat, but he's last year, first serve percentage was about 80%.
Insane.
And he doesn't go for a small serve. It's big.
Yeah.
Only one player had a bigger serve rate than him, and it was Sebastian Baez, but he kick serves a lot to start the point.
Yeah.
So he's on to something, and I believe that if he gets his mind together, his forehand becomes as sharp as his backhand, he's going to be one to win a slam.
I have no this is a separate conversation, but you're speaking to it directly. I think he's my number one pick for a new slam winner.
Right.
Out of the people who have not won one yet, I don't think it's even close. I think him and Tsitsipas, it's like this. You know, I really think that Zverev can beat Alcaraz. He can beat Sinner.
Right.
He can beat Djokovic. I think we talked about this a little bit in our previous slam speculation. He has big enough game to take those guys off the court.
Yes.
You know, and he's also one of those anomaly 6'5", fantastic movers like Medvedev.
Right.
You know, who's proven that it makes a difference. So, yeah, I love that you said that. I think that Zverev is the next in line if there's someone who's going to get a slam. I don't think he enters the conversation of being a sinner.
Okay, that's fair. And Nadal was asked this question. He may not be making a lot of noise on court, but he's making a lot of noise. This is what he said. They are amazing players, but at the same time, if we put it into perspective, Novak won 3 Grand Slams and played in the final of another. Things haven't changed that much, have they? And the question was, is Alcaraz and Sinner separating themselves? And is the new current level of tennis higher now than the past level of tennis? That was the question, and that was his response.
I love his response.
What are your thoughts on his response?
I love his response. And let's speak to Nadal. Every time he sits down with media, some form or relative question to this comes up, which is these new guys that you haven't played that much, what do you think of them compared to you and your guys that we've already seen so much of? And he always finds a way to make them seem smaller. You know, he makes a statement of they play low IQ tennis. They rely on brute force. They just hit the ball hard. They're not actually dominating yet. We dominated. Djokovic is still their rival. How much sense does that make? Because he was my rival and I was beating him when I needed to. He's saying a lot of logical, factual things we can't deny. And is it true that these guys are beating Medvedev, Zverev, and Tsitsipas? Yes. Was Nadal doing that? Was Djokovic doing that already? Yeah. I love that he's putting things into perspective for us and keeping us on earth as fans, because we love to latch on to the hottest, latest, newest winner of things. But at the end of the day, he's right. Sinner and Alcaraz still haven't actually stepped on the neck and killed Djokovic yet. And until they do that, can we say anything about the level of tennis being higher? Because what is Djokovic really doing at a brand new level right now versus 4 or 5 years ago?
Right.
Not a whole lot. I mean, he's playing clean. He's probably the pinnacle of the sport of tennis. He's probably the best player to ever hold a racket. But they still haven't surpassed it. And Nadal was a legitimate rival to that person. So I love what Nadal said. I think he's onto something. I agree.
Yes, I think this is actually a funny statement. So Sabalenka was asked if she watches WTA tennis. And she said no, she prefers to watch ATP tennis. And the reason for it is because there's more tactics involved. But Nadal, Federer, they all say they all bang. They all hit the same. There's no variety in the game. There is no tactics in the game. And it's just becoming brute force. And it's kind of boring to watch. So Nadal making that statement is brilliant to me.
Yeah, I love it.
Yes. So you said you had a couple of things you wanted to bring up.
I think you actually snuck in most of them. I have one last little tidbit I want to bring up, and it has to do with the World Tour Finals and the rankings.
Okay.
So I wanted to talk to you about what the current top 10 is, points-wise, and also, in comparison to that, who is locking in positioning for the year-end tournament as well.
Okay.
Because it's a little bit different from the top 10. First and foremost, let's talk about our rankings, because there's no mystery here. Our rankings have Dimitrov, Hurkacz, Rublev, Tsitsipas, Casper Ruud, Zverev, Medvedev, Alcaraz, Sinner, Djokovic.
Right.
Let's talk about the most significant difference between the two right off the bat. The number one player in the world rankings is almost in last place and isn't in the top eight right now for the year-end tournament. He has not collected almost any points. He has 1,300 points to get into the year-end tournament. Our leading guy is over 4,000. So Djokovic has a lot of work to do if we're going to see him at the World Tour Finals, which is why I think he's being very particular about what he does at this next slam. And you could probably guess who the top few guys are based off of tournament wins and slam wins. But Casper Ruud is our number three leader.
Yes.
Number three leader in the year in tournament as of right now. And Alcaraz is second to last. He's only ahead of Dimitrov in our top eight players to play in the year in tournament right now. And we're halfway into the year.
Wow.
What are your thoughts on Dimonor beating Alcaraz and Dimitrov and being number six to get to the year in tournament?
He's been playing solid tennis. He's made a lot of tournament results that he hasn't made in the past. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense why he's there. Alcaraz, unfortunately, has been struggling with his ailments right now. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't been able to capitalize with what he was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. He was the Barcelona champion. He didn't compete. He lost all those points. Mm-hmm. He's the Madrid champ. He's going to have to defend that. And if he makes it, you know, if he doesn't make it, there's problems there. So he could drop in the year-end tournament.
Yeah.
So I can see that.
And one last fun fact on this. One of the guys I just said to you is in the top eight to play in the year-end finals, but he's not ranked even in the top 10 on the tour. What that means is someone's spot got taken, and they're not even in the top 10 for the year-end finals. That player is Rublev.
Whoa.
Rublev is still ranked in the top 10 in the rankings, but Rublev has not enough points to even be in contention as a substitute to play in the year-end finals halfway into the year. Do you think he's having a really bad year?
I mean, he is, okay, he's still making quarterfinals. Mm-hmm. He is doing that. He's just not doing better than what he has. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of maintaining the same, mm-hmm. whereas others are doing more. Dimonor, Casper mm-hmm. Ruud now. Mm-hmm. So they're all surpassing what he's been doing consistently.
Yeah.
It's not that he hasn't had a terrible year, in my opinion.
Okay, I like that response. And that's pretty much everything I've got for you.
All right. In that case, I hope you guys were entertained.
See you later. ATP, like, subscribe, and comment on the videos.